Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got the sage grouse, we've got a parole board audit, much more, UTA. And joining me in studio is Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson. Lee, with his tie on, you must be headed to the Capitol.
Yeah, I wanted to look good on the radio today.
Looking good. Also with us in studio, Justice reporter Jessica Miller is here. Jessica, good morning.
Good morning.
And editorial writer George Pyle is with us once again. Good morning, George.
Good morning.
And you are welcome to join us, too. What are the headlines that caught your eye this week? You can put comments online, sltrib.com. You can tweet us to the hashtag TribTalk, or you can call us. 801-355-TALK is that number. 801-355-8255. Let's start with a Capitol Hill update. Lots going on. Utah Transit Authority actually making an appearance on Capitol Hill. What did they say to state lawmakers?
Well, it was an unusual appearance because they weren't appearing to testify about any legislation. They just showed up to say that they are working on reform. They know that they have been controversial. Proposition 1 to raise transportation taxes, including taxes for transit, went down in several key counties this last year. So they showed up to say, you know, we know we've been controversial. We're trying to fix our image and work on reform.
Why is UTA getting the blame for the failure of Prop 1?
Both sides agree that it was UTA. So there's not a lot of disagreement there. But there was controversy over high salaries, high wages, sweetheart deals for developers, extensive international travel. And they say they have taken steps to rectify all of that. They've changed a lot of board policies. They say that legislative auditors have agreed that they have taken a lot of steps that they had recommended.
Mm-hmm. So UTA going, I guess, on the offensive a little bit and saying, we're sorry. And I mean,
a lot. There's talk up there of a lot of things. There's some bills that would redo Prop 1 like tax increases so that perhaps no money would go to UTA. So UTA is trying to say, see, we're trying to be good guys now. There's talk about changing how UTA is governed. Some politicians have proposed making it an elected board instead of an appointed board. There's no legislation on that yet. But like you said, they're kind of going on the offensive, trying to inoculate themselves against a lot of the attacks that have been made on them.
Is it going to work, George Pyle? I mean, how long would it take and what would it take for Utah Transit Authority to redeem themselves?
It probably is going to take some real big structural change. The way it's set up now, everybody on the board is appointed by somebody else, and the accountability is really kind of strained. And so the idea that we would, as the voters, would elect members of this board, but there you have a situation where it would kind of maybe be like a school board. It's very important, but nobody knows who's on it. Or you could have a situation like you do with councils of governments where everybody on the board is an elected official. It's like the mayor of Salt Lake City, the mayor of Sandy, the mayor, a county council member, at least people who are individually directly responsible to the voters. I mean, and so they would have to face the voters, not just for their vote on the Sandy City Council, but their vote on the UTA board. That is another possible way that you could do it. But it is interesting, if you look back, if you look at the comments and the letters to the editor way back, say, when they were building tracks, then you have a lot of comments about how, well, I don't know if public transit is really a good idea. Public transit costs a lot of money. You see a lot of buses that are empty. Now, the discussion really isn't, do we need public transit or not? It seems to be pretty well accepted that we do, especially in this environment where we're worried about air quality and we want to cut down on the number of cars that are on the road. Even though there's the old saw about, I'm in favor of mass transit, so everybody else rides it and there'll be more room for me to drive my car. And there's some truth in that. Now it becomes governance. Now it becomes the money they spend, the salaries, the junkets, things like that. I mean, you go out and you find, you know, the retired executive bishop of the LDS Church. You think, well, isn't that enough to clean up our act? Isn't that enough to get people to trust us? Well, apparently not. And so you had lots of people saying, well, I would have voted for Prop 1 if it was just for roads, but because those dirty guys at UTA are going to make money off it, I'm voting no.
How was this newfound humility taken by state lawmakers? I mean, obviously, they're not up there advocating for any bill in particular. They're just shining their reputation a little bit.
Well, it was just before one committee, and the chairman of that committee, his name is Johnny Anderson, Republican in Taylorsville, praised them for taking these steps. And H. David Burton, who's the chairman of the UTA board, former presiding bishop of the LDS Church, he said, I think you stepped into a beehive's nest here. I think you've been doing a good job trying to clean things up. So at least with him, you know, he's making progress. And Anderson's a key person. You know, he's the chairman of the Transportation Committee, and he's the one who passed the gasoline tax and the bill last year that allowed Prop 1. So.
And are there particular bills other than the two that you mentioned, are they making progress? Let's take the bill that would allow smaller counties to explore a tax hike option and how much money would go toward transit. Is that making progress?
That advanced in committee this week. It allows little counties like Cache and Summit that have small bus systems to not give as much money as Prop 1 would mandate. It would have said 40% of any tax increase goes to transit. This allows them to maybe give 10%. They say it makes sense in areas with small bus systems. For example, in Cedar City, it would have mandated more money going to its bus system than its local roads. And they said, that's wrong for us. Please don't make us do it. But Brian Green, Pleasant Grove Republican, has a bill that would perhaps take all money away from UTA. He promised to do that last year against he was among the people trying to kill Prop 1 in Utah County and help kill it. And he promised to run this sort of bill. Counties and cities are opposing that. So that one doesn't have as much promise as the one affecting just the small counties.
Okay. Before we leave transit, you reported this week on two Utah communities who operate their own little transit systems and maybe some lessons that Salt Lake City could take from that as they explore creating their own transit system.
Yeah. Park City and Cache Valley Transit have bus systems that charge no fare. And they say it works well for them. In Cache County, they spent a year looking at whether to start charging fares, and they figured it actually cost them money by installing fare boxes and slowing down their system. And people not riding it, et cetera. They're happy with no fare. Say it works well. They say it's well-funded.
How do they fund it?
Sales tax. And actually, they charge less in sales tax than the Wasatch Front does for transit. And federal grants. And in Park City, they use business licenses. They say they don't really need a lot to expand. If they expand, they need more money. But not as much as Prop 1 would mandate. UTA likes to say, you're comparing apples to oranges. Don't compare us to them. We're totally different. We have tracks and front runner and some expensive to build systems that are far different. So we need to charge fares. And anyway.
That's some food for thought for the new mayor of Salt Lake City. I mean, George Pyle from the opinion page, is Mayor Biskupski right to look at this idea?
Well, she was in to see the editorial board the other day, and one of the things she said, we asked her specifically about, like, expanding the Sugar House S line and things like that. And one of her campaign pledges was, before we spend a zillion dollars on more street trolley cars, before we make this decision as to whether we ought to have our own parallel transit system running separate from UTA, we need to finish this transit study. And that was part of the controversy that was before the council, and part of the knock on Mayor Becker was that he was trying to move ahead with these individual piecemeal little things before they had finished their overall transit study. So Mayor Biskupski now says, I want to finish this transit study. We've done phase one. We're into phase two. Not sure what the difference between phase one and phase two is. It just means it's not done yet. And when that's done, then she wants to come back to the council and have a discussion about, is it a good idea to lay more track, which is really expensive? But it gives certainty to, like, people who want to build apartments near trains because they know that will always be there. And that was Ralph Becker's mantra, and that's part of the reason he's not mayor anymore. He made so many people mad by pushing that. Do we want to have UTA run more buses within Salt Lake City, getting and not so much their commuter to and from Salt Lake City mindset that they have, which is part of the reason why it's not free, because they have a much larger system? Or does the city of Salt Lake City need to start buying and running some of its own buses so that the idea of getting from the avenues to Sugar House in less than 2.5 hours is something that's possible?
That is a discussion to be continued. Let's stick on Capitol Hill for a moment. Lee, legislators have not been able to agree on a Medicaid expansion plan to provide health coverage for Utahns in need. This week, you reported that Representative Patrice Arendt has a proposal on the table. What's the story?
Well, she wants voters to weigh in on it. She has a proposal to create a system where you could put non-binding questions on the ballot. So in something controversial like Medicaid expansion, perhaps to give political cover to hesitant lawmakers, you could ask voters, what do you think? Should we expand Medicaid? Jim Dunnigan, the Republican majority leader, does not like the idea. He says, if anything, if they pass a bill to allow that sort of thing, he thinks a lot of lawmakers would say, well, we don't need to do anything this year. Let's wait another year to see what voters say on this.
What's the rationale from Representative Arendt? I mean, a lot of public opinion polls have been done on this. Utahns support helping those who fall into the coverage gap. So, I mean, what's the advantage of a vote over a poll?
She says it would be more powerful because it's voters voting. Like you said, there have been a lot of polls on this. The Tribune and the Hinckley Institute of Politics did a poll showing a plurality favor expanding Medicaid, 44% to 39%. But more than anything, Arendt, I think, is trying to draw attention that nothing's happened, and she's just prodding action. She wants something to happen. And if all else fails, she thinks this might be a way to have something move forward.
Well, so other lawmakers, other proposals, are lawmakers going to have another go at Medicaid expansion this year?
Yes. Dunnigan, for example, is drafting a proposal that would handle about a third of the people in the uninsured gap. He says about 44,000 people don't qualify for Medicaid and don't qualify for essentially Obamacare. And his bill would handle about a third of the problem. He says most of that, but not all of it, would be homeless people. And says it would stabilize that population and help them. He says he's going for the poorest of the poor with his proposal.
Okay.
Other, Governor Herbert and the Senate have passed, but the House has blocked, a much more generous proposal last year. But they've still made it in trying to find a solution.
The Tribune editorial board, George, you've sent strong message after strong message on this one. What do you think about an incremental approach, as Representative Dunnigan has suggested?
Well, if it's all that will pass, I suppose that it would have to be acceptable. And it would be targeted toward, for example, the homeless people, and that would make a big difference in handling the homeless problem. It's the same thing with their criminal justice reform, where they've said that we're going to save money by routing people away from jail and into treatment. Okay, where's the treatment? Have they paid for that? Well, no, not really. You know who might pay for that? Obamacare. Oh, no, we can't have Obamacare. So they're kind of stuck on that. Well, they might come up with a way. They might have to go get more waivers, which they might or might not get, from President. And now we're already starting to look at the next administration for some of these things being pushed down the road. If we did have an advisory election, that would be a good excuse for the people in the legislature who are allergic to this to just say, well, we have to wait and see what the results of the election are. Plus, then you put it on a ballot, and then that arguably that's less accurate to what people really want than a scientific poll, because then it's a self-selected sample of people who bother to vote. Plus, you'll have Americans for Prosperity bombarding the airwaves with anti-Obamacare advertising, which is fine. That's free speech. But idea that it would be a reflective vote of what people really want, I'm not sure that's the way it would come out.
You noted that the Senate has been willing to expand Medicaid. The obstacle's been in the House. With Representative Dunnigan as the sponsor of this bill, he's got a lot of clout as House Majority Leader. I mean, is he pretty confident that he can push something through?
I don't know how confident he is. He notes that a lot of House members want to wait until the presidential election's over to see if Obamacare might be repealed, for example. But he says he's going to push this and see what happens. Okay. He thinks it is the best chance of something passing this year.
Okay. Let's move on to one other issue. House Minority Leader Brian King is taking on how Utah teachers talk about sex in health class. And what's his proposal, Lee?
Well, he wants to allow comprehensive sex education.
What does that mean?
That you can talk about everything. Currently, Utah schools have what they call Abstinence Plus. Both sides essentially say it's abstinence only. It allows talking about a little bit more than that, some contraception, but not a lot more. He said, quote, "Knowledge is power. I don't believe in keeping our kids ignorant." He wants them to be able to ask about anything. He says that rates of sexually transmitted diseases are increasing at alarming rates in Utah. It's opposed by conservatives, especially Gail Ruzicka, president of the Utah Eagle Forum. She said, quote, "Comprehensive sex education is all about teaching children that it's okay to have sex as long as they use a condom. It just doesn't work." Hmm. And she says, truthfully, that Utah ranks low in a lot of sexually transmitted diseases and abortion. And she says it's because of the abstinence only. She says if you use comprehensive education, it just encourages kids to go out and fool around.
George, we hear both the opponent and the supporter using statistics.
Yes.
Any chance that lawmakers are going to be swayed with the numbers, or is this truly a moral issue?
No, I don't think facts enter into this. But, I mean, our editorial this morning was, you know, the current law about how you teach sex to teenagers is currently obviously written by people who were never teenagers. I mean, the idea that teenagers don't think about sex unless it's raised in class, I mean, there is a certain evolutionary mandate here that pushes this, plus some things that conservatives are worried about, which is they refer to as the over-sexualization of society, movies, TV, commercials. You know, they use sex to sell everything. Well, that's not wrong. And you would think that if you're worried about all these images in the culture pushing people toward sexual expression and sexual behavior, maybe that's more reason why you should have true comprehensive sex education in school, so that they can get some of the truth and not just what they happen to pick up from their friends or happen to read online, and they would really know what's happening. It does come down less to statistics and more to ethics. You know, the one side that says don't tell them about them because then they'll want to do it, and which in my view is insane, and the other side which says just tell them the truth, the whole truth.
Lee, where does Representative King's bill stand right now?
It's just been introduced. In the House, you have to go through something called the Rules Committee, which decides whether to give it to a standing committee for a hearing. It may not ever get out of rules. We'll see. It's not expected to move very far because the legislature is overwhelmingly conservative, overwhelmingly Republican. And King knows that, and he says this may be a multi-year process, but he wants to keep bringing it up and thinks that it would be worthwhile.
Okay. I know you need to get to the Hill, but I want to just touch on two other quick bills, one of which has to do with sex. A Utah lawmaker wants to declare pornography a public health crisis. And this is from Senator Todd Weiler. It's a resolution. It got airtime around the country. George, what do you think?
Well, it's another one of those things where all the comedians pick up on this and say, boy, they sure are weird in Utah, aren't they? And they don't really go into the discussion of it. It's just a resolution. It doesn't make any laws. It doesn't ban anything. It doesn't spend any money. It, you know, if it makes them feel better, fine. It doesn't, as my understanding, it doesn't really define pornography. It just says pornography is bad. Well, as the Supreme Court once said, you know, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. Then everybody can feel better saying, oh, you know, we've made a statement. Okay, now let's go on and do something else. It's silly. It's a waste of time. But it doesn't really hurt anybody. So, sure, if it makes you feel better.
Other action, front page news this morning, two bills cleared a Senate committee yesterday that would, two different paths to legalizing medical marijuana. And the full Senate last year, it failed by one vote. So do you think it will be as open a reception this time around? George Pyle?
Well, the fact that both bills got through the committee, apparently I wasn't there, but apparently a very emotional hearing went on for quite a while. People talking about how they've, you know, they've left the state and gone to states where marijuana is either legal for medicinal purposes or just legal, period. And that they got relief from horrible maladies that nothing else took care of. And what's interesting about this is Utah is also suffering from a huge problem with opioids and overdoses and doctor shopping and doctors going to jail for over-prescribing this stuff. I mean, if you invented opiates and marijuana today, if they were both brand new, any sane society would distribute the marijuana and keep the opioids in the lab. They have so many more side effects, so many more potential for damaging people, much more addictive. But the opioids are made by big pharmaceutical companies, which, you know, come in suits and briefcases and take people to lunch. And the marijuana is grown in people's window boxes. There's money to be made, but there's not a big corporate push for it. But the fact that both bills got through the Senate committee and it's being accurately, I think, portrayed as just compassion for people who are in a bad way. The studies, the double-blind, peer-reviewed medical studies aren't there, partly because the federal government had just determined by fiat, like in the 30s, that there wasn't any point in it.
Lee, what's the chatter on the Hill? I mean, are people talking about the medical marijuana bills?
Yeah. Those who are concerned, even though they're concerned, they still sort of support it. They just don't want it to allow recreational use. They don't want people who want to use it recreationally just be able to go to some kind of club or bar to smoke it. If they see it as being prescribed, something that you would get, you know, from a pharmacist or a doctor in gummy form instead of maybe smoking it, they tend to support that.
Hmm. Well, it'll be very interesting to see how that debate develops. Lee, I know you've got to get back to Capitol Hill. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
You've got to watch these guys every time.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay around.
Crossing the border to get to high school from Mexico to the U.S. is just part of life for a lot of students in El Paso.
If you want to succeed and if you want to have, a life, you could say, you have to go for it and you have to get an education because it's important to get one.
Yeah, it is. I'm Kai Rizdahl, back to El Paso for our series My Economy next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Join us Friday night at 6:30 on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Logan Regional Hospital Nutrition Services, helping people live a healthier life through programs directed to prevent diabetes and heart disease. Information at loganregional.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and joining me today, George Pyle, Jessica Miller, and Rachel Piper, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. We're talking about the week's top stories, and if you want to join our conversation, you can tweet us to the hashtag TribTalk. You can comment online, sltrib.com. You can also call us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Rachel, front page story today in the Tribune, Utah is challenging the plan for the sage grouse. Tell us a little bit about the lawsuit.
Well, in September, the federal government decided not to list the greater sage grouse as an endangered species, which, you know, a lot of people said was a win because that's what states were worried about in the West, saying, you know, this bird is now endangered. This really prevents us from, you know, touching or getting near them or developing anything near their habitat. But it came with some pretty strict BLM plans, really complicated, like 99 different plans for the state for how this habitat can be managed. Utah had been working on its own kind of preservation plan for the sage grouse, and says that the federal plan is contradictory and less protecting of the sage grouse. And so they're suing to say, we don't want your plan, we want our plan. And some environmentalists are saying, like, okay, if you sue and you win, they're going to list the sage grouse as an endangered species. So then you've lost.
Which
again.
Complicates your yeah. lives even more. Where does the sage grouse live?
Well, in Utah, I mean, we have a very small population of the overall sage grouse population. It's like something like 6 or 9%. And in Utah, they live in little islands, so they're kind of like scattered across the state. Whereas in Nevada and Wyoming, they have the sagebrush seas, which is basically huge swaths of land that the sage grouse live in. So that's a little bit easier to manage because you can just like draw a big circle and say this is where the sage grouse lives. Where in Utah, it's kind of, there's little pockets here and there.
So it's the Utah plan would really be more catered to the unique challenges that Utah faces as a habitat.
Right, right. The federal government who made this plan says, you know, we didn't just plop down a plan that exists for everyone. I mean, the fact that there are so many specific plans, they went for it on this specific level. They say the state says, no, you don't understand Utah. The federal government said, well, we tried to.
George Pyle, what do you think? I mean, should Utah be involved in litigation around the sage grouse plan?
It just seems like another opportunity for them to bash the federal government. I mean, the sage grouse didn't get listed, which is with what we thought Utah was so worried about happening. Other states have gone along with this. And, you know, Wyoming, yeah. I guess. I mean, they were even part of the announcement. They were so happy that it came out this way. So it's not like it's this West against Washington thing. The other states involved are happy with or okay with the way the plan came out. The way the population is scattered does complicate it a little bit. But to me, it's almost like they were expecting the species to be listed, and they were ready to fight. And then when the species wasn't listed, they still wanted to fight. So they have this constituency that says, well, if you're not fighting the federal government, what good are you?
Did this lawsuit come as a bit of a surprise to conservation groups, or were they sort of expecting a continued argument from state of Utah?
Yeah, I mean, like George said, Utah made it pretty clear that they wanted to fight this. And Utah was and still is spending $2 million a year to kind of block efforts to previously list the sage grouse and now to get their own plan through.
So now that a lawsuit has been filed, the plan is on hold, I'm assuming. I mean, who's going to be hearing this?
Well, it's unclear because I think Nevada also had an issue with the plan. And so far, I think the feds have declined to stop it or do anything else until I think this is the most formal complaint we've had so far. And this will probably trigger some decisions.
Okay. We will continue to follow this very closely at the Salt Lake Tribune. Let's move on to an audit. Jessica, lawmakers heard the results of an audit into the State Board of Pardons and Parole. First off, before we get to the audit, what does the State Board of Pardons and Parole do?
Well, they do a lot of things. They've made 18,000 decisions in the last year, and they decide everything from when a prisoner gets out of prison, what their parole, what they have to do on parole, and then if they violate parole, they kind of deal with that also.
And 18,000 decisions in a year?
1 year, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, and they have this huge discretion to do basically what they want. In Utah, our prisoners have indeterminate sentences. So if you're sentenced to a third degree felony, the judge can only say you're going to serve a 0 to 5 year sentence, or a second degree felony is 1 to 15 years, and a typical first degree felony is a 5 year to life sentence. And so the judge gives you that. But as far as whether you serve 5 years, whether you serve 20 years, whether you serve your whole life, that's up to the parole board to decide. And they can basically do whatever they want. They don't really have to give you a reason, like this is why you're here for this long. Though their decisions can't be appealed they're basically the final word in what goes on in these prisoners' lives and when they might be free again.
And who's on this board?
That's a good question. I am not sure, actually. I know that it's a lot of attorneys, other important people.
There's
but
a
I'm not
story
sure.
there. There's a story there. So what did the audit find?
The audit found that they needed to make a lot of changes, going to more of a evidence-based practice, because at this point, you know, they come in and they have this hearing and then they just decide, well, based on my experience, I think that you should get this amount of time, or let's have a rehearing in 5 years. And there's really not much as far as like evidence-based why we should do this. It's a lot on this is my experience, this is how I feel, and it's kind of the punishments are being doled out inconsistently. Hmm. So they're saying that they should adopt more of these evidence-based practices, and then make that process more transparent to the public. Right now, they really have nothing transparent that the public can see as far as what that process is, what their goals are, what statistics say. They don't have another thing that they wanted changed was they still do everything on paper. So they don't have any statistics because they're still lugging like paper files around the hallways. And so there's no one taking that data and saying, oh, well, we have higher amount of time that people spend in prison, but here's why. And this is, you know, this is important. It's more of like, well, we really don't know. Yeah, prison sentences have gone up, but is that making a difference, or is it just costing taxpayers more money? Well, we don't know because we don't have anyone to kind of crunch that data because everything is still sitting in filing cabinets. We're not looking at this in a better way. And so that's like the big change, is moving to a paperless filing system, getting online, you know, kind of getting with the times here and getting on a computer so that they can kind of crunch that data and then use that data to make the decisions better, so it's just not all emotional or experience based for who the parole board is at that moment.
And of course, this audit comes at the same time that there's been some highlighted scrutiny because of a Utah police officer who was shot and killed by somebody who was released by this parole board. I'm sure that's only intensified the magnifying glass on this organization.
Exactly. And that was actually a question that someone asked, and of course it didn't make it into my story, but they asked about that, and the director basically said it was like a miscommunication. Like there was something that happened. They didn't get all the information, and then that led to this person being let out. So in her opinion, she didn't think that this was like an error in the entire process, but kind of an anomaly with that one case, which unfortunately had this terrible outcome.
Hmm. George Pyle from the opinion page. Do you buy that argument that what happened in the Officer Barney shooting was an anomaly?
Well, I think that what the audit says is that we don't know. I mean, it's all kind of on the back of envelopes someplace, and it's all stuffed in a filing cabinet. I was really surprised to read this. I didn't understand. I mean, today everything is data driven and statistics, and you know, private sector, public sector, you know, what's the data show? And they have no data. And you can say that you don't just want to make people into statistics. It can't just be how old are you, you know, what's your educational level, how many tattoos do you have, punch it in the computer, and you get the number of years somebody's supposed to spend in prison. You should have some human judgment in that. But at the same time, if it's just kind of, well, how's this guy look? Does he smell okay? You know, is there a certain number of piercings that put us off? Was he in a good mood when he came to the parole board? Was the parole board in a good mood when he came to the parole board? And if you have judgments based on just, you know, how people feel that day, then you're going to make a lot of mistakes both ways. And that's not fair to the prisoners. That's not fair to the public. That's not fair to the families of the inmates who are waiting for their loved ones to get out. And it doesn't improve public safety at all. And the parole board, my understanding is, they looked at this audit and they said, yeah, good idea, let's do that, as if, you know, they had to wait for somebody to tell them. I would imagine part of the problem is money. And now that they have an audit that says, hey, you guys ought to do this, then it helps them go to the legislature and say, see, this audit says we ought to do this. fork over. Come on, we need to buy computers. You know, you can't just do this without money. Money is at the basis of everything. So hopefully with this, the legislature will say, yeah, you know, we really ought to do it this way. Here's the check.
Is that how the board responded to the audit's conclusions?
Yeah. They were really receptive, said they basically wanted to make all these changes, especially going to computers. But the
it's
audit,
still hard for me to wrap around my head. Like 18,000 cases a year, and they're all on paper.
Yeah, they're just pushing
the
cards
around. Year.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the audit specifically said, don't come to the legislature and ask for money because you have a surplus in funds and there's federal grants that can kind of make this happen for you. And one of the questions asked at this hearing was, well, how is this even happening? Like, how do you not have a computer? Like, did you come to the legislature and you were rejected? Like, what happened? And they were like, well, no, we've never asked for money. But we're just so busy making these decisions on all these cases. Mm. There hasn't been that time to like take a step back and say, whoa, this isn't really working anymore. And so now that they've had this audit done, now they see the problems and hopefully they can go forward from here and reconfigure the budget, ask for federal money, take all those steps first before coming to the legislature and asking for state funding to make those changes happen.
Okay. But we've always done it this way is very powerful. Private sector, public sector, anywhere you go.
Yeah. Certainly a story to follow.
Yes.
Before we leave the criminal justice desk, there is a bill that you reported on this week. Senator Wyler, again, is sponsoring a bill for better public defense. Tell us about this indigent defense bill.
Well, it hasn't been unveiled yet, but what's kind of expected is, well, let me just start from the beginning. This is proposed legislation is a result of about 4 years of study by a state task force, including they hired the Sixth Amendment Center to do a report on how Utah is doing with our constitutional obligation to provide public defenders and indigent defense to people. And the report came out in October, and it showed that we had a lot of flaws. There were people who go to justice court who should have had the opportunity to have an attorney and they just were never given one. Or in district court where kind of the heavier charges are, they might have an attorney, but they're one of 400 clients and there's no money for experts. There's no money for private investigators. There's nothing there for them. And so this bill would kind of create a statewide commission that would oversee indigent defense in Utah, because in Utah, we're one of two states that have kind of put that burden, our constitutional burden of providing this to the counties, saying each county, you do it yourself, which results in kind of this patchwork of indigent defense. In Salt Lake County, we've got an association that does it. In, you know, Washington County, they do contracted private attorneys who do it. So it's kind of this patchwork. So this commission will oversee all of this, hopefully make it a little more, bring everyone up to par as far as what they're offering. But the big thing that people are kind of waiting to see is how much money is involved, because you've got people or these rural counties who don't have the money to pay their public defender contracts. And so they're saying, well, yeah, these are all great changes, but how do we pay for this? And they're looking for the state to do that for them.
Okay, so that's where Senator Wyler steps in?
Yes, yeah, that's what the bill will do. I talked with him last week about this, and he wouldn't say much as far as like what kind of money, how much the bill would propose. He said maybe a couple million, but the people I've talked to who are asking for these changes said, well, a couple million isn't going to be enough. Like, it's going to have to be a lot of money to reform this system in a meaningful way.
Okay. That is certainly an important story that we'll continue to follow. On the subject of money, let's turn to schools, which it's the perennial school funding issue. This year, a group of business leaders has been actively trying to boost the school funding yet again. This year, they're backing a tax hike. And Rachel, what's the story?
Well, yeah, it's this business group, Education First and Prosperity 2020. They say people in Utah want more money for education. You know, most polls say, yes, let's put more money in schools. But they say the lawmakers are a little bit skittish about that. So in their minds, let's take it directly to the voters, ask them for a what would be the equivalent of a 0.78% income tax increase.
Across the state.
Across the state. And that would, they say, would funnel $500 million a year to schools. And so they're pushing that proposal. And it's sort of interesting. You know, last year we had Herbert, we had teachers asking for hikes. And this year it seems to be that movement is coming kind of from the outside. Other groups are stepping in saying, yeah, maybe we do need more money.
Do they have proposals on how they would spend that $500 million?
No, I hasn't gotten down to that level of specificity yet. Okay. I think it would probably, a lot of it would be up to the districts.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, they were in to see the editorial board a couple of weeks ago, and they were pretty, they don't have it down to every specific, but the idea was that it would go to the districts, and it wouldn't get funneled through the state system for the state to siphon any of it off. It would go to the districts to give people some confidence that it really would go into classroom instruction and necessary things and not get sucked off by the bureaucracy.
Well, why this year? It's an election year, George. I mean, how willing are lawmakers going to be to a tax hike?
Well, I mean, that's, again, like we were talking about with the Medicaid expansion, this is a way that they think they want to put this on the ballot. And it would, again, be sort of an advisory thing because it wouldn't actually be a law, a bill. It would be a referendum. And they're hoping that the people would vote for it. And then the legislature would see, oh, I guess the people really do want to spend more money on education. You know, all that, all those phone calls I get and all those letters I get and all those polls that are taken. Well, you know, now we have an election. People want to spend more money on schools. It kind of, I mean, we used to have basically a 7% income tax rate in Utah. Governor Huntsman cut that down to 5%, kind of the idea that, well, okay, we'll stimulate the economy, we'll make more money. Well, we didn't. The economy recovered, but the idea that lower taxes equals more economic activity equals more revenue never works. So now they want some of that back, just like less than half of what was cut. Now, you could make the argument that it's just kind of a flat tax. It would be sort of regressive. It would hurt as a percentage of what you need to live. It would hurt low and moderate income people more than it would hurt the rich people who are pushing it. But this is one of those cases where, you know, you hear, oh, God, we're being ruled by the 1%. The 1% don't care about us. In Utah, the 1% want to do this. The 1% want to spend more money on education. They're willing to have their own taxes raised along with everybody else's. And so this is the kind of thing that when you have Gail Miller and Kem Gardner and the president of Zions Bank stand up and say, we need to do this, there is... Unfortunately, it's who you know, and this might actually get done.
Rachel, what is the impetus? Why is the business community saying we need to invest in education, people?
Well, you know, Utah's scores, I mean, they haven't fallen, but they haven't really risen. You know, we're sort of flat. Other states are growing. Their scores are getting better. Their education is improving, apparently, and especially other countries. I mean, Utah does not want to fall behind. There's a big push for technology and jobs and engineering here, and people are looking at that and saying, okay, these jobs that you're creating, people who aren't Utah students are going to be coming in and filling these because they'll be more qualified than our students here.
Okay, so do they have a bill drafted? And who's the sponsor, and how are they going to get this onto the ballot? I guess is my question.
This is one of a kind of a package of education bills. I think there's going to be some more movement on this. I'm not sure of the bill number, who the sponsor is, but I know that we'll know that soon, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
George,
well, when they were in a couple of weeks ago, they told us they were still shopping for a sponsor. They had some hopes that somebody they had. They said productive conversations with members of the legislature, individuals who said they would be happy to carry the bill, but they didn't have any names for us yet.
Okay.
And, I mean, they want to get everything in a row and everything all lined up and not run into any unexpected minefields. They would like to get it on the ballot this year, this election year, and then so the legislature in 2017 would have the political cover, because they won't do anything without a lot of cover, to actually go ahead and do something like this to raise income taxes. If you don't do it now, then you got to wait for the election in 2018, then you're into 2019 before anything actually happens. And they feel, I mean, these are the business leaders, the people who are trying to recruit other businesses to Utah, and we're not recruiting GM factories anymore. We're recruiting Adobe and Microsoft and things like that, and we need a really educated workforce for these companies to give us a second look.
Yeah. It'll be very interesting to see how this progresses. We're talking about Utah's top stories, and we need to take another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio.
Imagine you could see the unseeable.
I'm just imagining, like...
Imagine you woke up and your body was a cockroach.
I'm Elise Spiegel.
And I'm Lulu Miller. And we'd like to introduce you to Invisibilia, a show about the invisible forces that shape human behavior.
Like fear.
And thoughts.
They're just synapses popping off in our head.
Join us for Invisibilia.
Careful out there in the light.
Join us for Invisibilia. Friday mornings at 10 and Saturday afternoons at 3 through February 6th, right here on Utah Public Radio.
I'm Robin Young. The rural town of Marion, Alabama struggles to contain a tuberculosis outbreak, worse than many developing countries, 100 times higher than the rest of the state and probably the country.
I would say that there are probably not very many towns at all in the United States that have a case rate that high.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Time for our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. And Jessica, would you like to kick us off?
Oh, sure. So I wrote a story that ran in Sunday's paper that talked about some developments about life without parole sentences for teenagers or juveniles, people under 18, who most often they're committing murder and then they get sentenced to life without parole. So there's two things kind of in the news about this. There's a legislative bill that's proposed that will eliminate that as a sentencing option. So basically saying if you're under 18, you can't be sent to prison for the rest of your life without ever having the chance to get out. And it hasn't been unveiled yet, so I don't know the specifics of it. But people who are supportive of it, they say it's important because kids are different than adults. You know, their brains are different. How their mind works is just a little bit differently. And so it's unfair to say, well, you did this horrible thing when you were 16, 17 years old, and you never deserve a chance to be looked at ever again. So there's that, and kind of connected to that, the U.S. Supreme Court made a ruling recently that said that those juveniles who had been sentenced to life without parole in the past should have a review done. And so that could affect a very small number of prisoners in Utah, like maybe two or maybe a couple more than that, but they could be receiving basically a parole hearing in the future where they'd been told, no way is that ever happening, and now that could happen for them.
Wow. If you missed the story, sltrib.com. Rachel, what's your pick?
My story involves an audit. It's by Annie Knox. USTAR, the Utah Science and Technology Research, something, you know, some long acronym. Sort of was a big touted project up at the U a few years ago, kind of working with USU and the U to make sort of products and economic impacts out of the research that's happening at universities. Is sort of touted as this big money-making machine. This audit, and it's come under a lot of fire recently. This audit was not as scathing as some of the past ones, but it shows that they still have a lot of work to do as far as how they're reporting how much money they're making. It seems like they're going to businesses and asking, what percentage of your business do you think was because of USTAR? And then the business is like, 3%, you know? And so that's like not good reporting. So that's an interesting thing to watch. You know, a lot of money went into that. They ripped up a lot of the U to build that, and we'll see what happens with it next.
USTAR. Okay, George Pyle.
Well, Jennifer, you know I tease you about underreported stories. If it's underreported, I don't know about it. But here's one that got a lot of play in the Washington Post and the New York Times, not so much around here. Jason Chaffetz, congressman from Utah, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, had two big hearings this week. Didn't quite go the way he wanted. The first one was about the situation in Flint, Michigan. The person they wanted to testify didn't show up, and Chaffetz literally sent the U.S. Marshals after him. They haven't found him yet. The second one was this Wall Street frat boy who bought this company, raised the price of this very important drug by 4,000% because he could. He came in, he took the Fifth Amendment like 20 times, and then went out and tweeted that the committee was a bunch of imbeciles. Because the committee didn't make an absolute fool of itself like it did during the Planned Parenthood hearing, nobody paid much attention. And this just goes to show you that these hearings can be sometimes really good television, but the hard work of legislating, that's not where it happens.
Well, I'm sure Representative Chaffetz will make sure that we hear about it in the coming days. George Pyle, Jessica Miller, and Rachel Piper of the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks.
We're going to wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby talks about cabin fever.
I could say that the time between New Year's and the onset of spring should be known as the Dark Ages. It's cold, it's grim, piles of dirty snow. And I'm waiting for things to grow again and sunlight to come out. Maybe it's a lack of vitamin D. I get restless.
Restless. You wrote about this back in 2005. Would you read a bit?
Sure. February is cabin fever month. Not only does it seem like spring will never come, there are no really effective holiday celebrations to break up the monotony. Cabin fever refers, of course, to a mental malady that afflicted prospectors in the Old West. Trapped by snow in their mountain shacks for months at a time, they gradually went stir-crazy. Sufferers of cabin fever sometimes invented imaginary friends. Others shot at imaginary enemies. A few ate each other for real. The worst off, if they survived, emerged to become leading politicians. Back then, there were but two ways to effectively treat cabin fever. Stay inside and go insane, or go outside and get eaten by a bear. Both had their merits. Cabin fever is still a threat today. Granted, there are fewer bears, but the fact remains that nobody in their right mind wants to be driven nuts enough to run for political office.
That is Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Always amusing. You can read all the Kirby archives, including this one, at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW, UPR, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Bennett Purser at UPR, and Emily Means from the Tribune. And thanks to everyone who joined us for our event, Bagley, the Pulitzers, and the Art of Political Cartooning this week at the Leonardo. It was terrific. The exhibit continues throughout the month, and you can hear a rebroadcast of that event on KCPW February 12th. That's a week from today at 10 a.m. and at 8 p.m. Tune in for that. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Thanks so much for listening.
It is clear that communities in northern Utah, the Uinta Basin, and Utah County need to clean up the air out there. So why do we continue to idle our cars, take short trips around the neighborhood, and avoid public transportation? Utah Public Radio wants to know what it will take to get you to take action. The conversation continues. Share your insight at upr.org.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KCEU 89.7 Price, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan. You're listening to Utah Public Radio.